I think there's a bad recession coming in the short term. And then long term, I think the U.S. dollar is especially, it's the kind of thing where everything might seem fine and then it's going to be quick. That if the spell is broken and a bunch of people around the world suddenly lose faith in the dollar, you're going to see, you know, a lot of, metaphorically, like a lot of dollars coming home and then prices rising here. Because it's like the flip side of, for decades, the U.S. has been effectively, yeah, like instead of sending just wheat and whatever, we just send $100 bills and people send us cars and computers and sweaters. And that's kind of a good deal from our point of view. Well, we just give you some digits electronically and you send us stuff. That's kind of good. But you're going to see the reverse of that, you know, if that spell is broken.
Dr. Murphy, welcome to the show, sir. This is Bitcoin Audible, and it is very good to have you. I'm actually surprised that I haven't actually reached out before to get you on the show. But it is great to have you, sir.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, man. It's one of those things with somebody that you've listened to a lot that you just kind of feel like you know them already. And I realize, like, we've never had a conversation. Mm-hmm. But I have listened to you a lot. You and Tom Woods were really kind of like at the crux of, and I guess this was like 15 or 17-ish years ago now, when we were really, really started going down the Austrian rabbit hole. It was funny. We did this. We were Keynesians, default, you know. Mm-hmm. And then my brother went to school for economics while we were living together. And for the life of him, he could not square all of the crap that they told him. And he would argue with his professors. And then he would come home and he would like break down like what it was. And it wouldn't make sense. Like it wouldn't, like he was like, what you told us last week and then what you told us this week, these things can't exist in the same universe. Like these mm-hmm. are contradictory. And they would get so pissed. And so then we found MMT. Mm-hmm. And that was actually more intuitive. It was actually a logically stronger argument. Until it obviously runs into take it to its logical conclusion and you've got a big problem. And then we found Austrian economics, Milton Friedman, you and Tom Woods, and like all of that stuff. So just to start this off, I just want to say thank you. And I've been a fan for a long time. It's cool to have you here.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for those kind of remarks. And yes, when I knew that I was going to do this show, I went and listened to some of your interviews, and I feel like we're kindred spirits, like your attitude and curiosity. And so I can at least say that I appreciate it. It's funny you say that about MMT because I've been talking more with people who are like friendly, like not so combative, but people who are mm-hmm. MMTers that are open. And a lot of them are actually ex-Austrians. And so it is a very similar. So it's kind of like I made a joke once that I would much rather, I think I could much easier convert someone to libertarianism who like starts out as a communist rather than someone who's a Mitt Romney or Hillary Clinton supporter. You know what I mean? Because they obviously, you know, if they're willing to just, you know, say, no, the current orthodoxy doesn't make any sense and have a weird view, mm-hmm. I can work with that. Whereas if someone says, oh no, I don't want to hold an opinion that other people are going to say is weird, then there's not much I can do with that kind of person.
Yeah. There's this difference between someone who believes what they believe because they don't want to be outside of the group. And then someone who believes what they believe because they've just come to a different logical conclusion than you, you know, mm-hmm. like you can at least logic with that person. You can argue with that person and actually get somewhere potentially.
Right.
Just in case some of the audience doesn't know who you are, do you mind just kind of giving a brief introduction and, you know, the shortest version of your history?
Yeah. So I, as a high school student, got into Austrian economics, libertarianism. I decided I had read Mises' Human Action. He's the biggest Austrian of the 20th century in that school. Yeah. And so that's what I want to do. I want to be a college professor. And I did go into academia, taught at Hillsdale College. Then I ended up at Texas Tech, but it wasn't for me, and I ended up in the private sector. And so now I have a great, you know, blend of both worlds. I'm at this company called Infinio, and, you know, working on real world stuff for people, but also still teaching people about what I think are the evils of central banking and government intervention into our financial system primarily. So that's, I've written lots of books, as you alluded to. I had a
choice
podcast with Tom Woods called Contra Krugman, where we would weekly take on the articles of Paul Krugman. And
that was great.
Yeah. Why Austrian economics we thought was superior to Keynesian economics.
Yeah. Well, on that note, choice, what got you writing choice? Like what was, I guess kind of a little bit in the book you cover this, but a lot of people may not have read it. And I have recommended it a couple of times, but I want to take the opportunity to actually show that book because I really like it. But kind of give me the thesis for choice and why you wrote it.
Well, sure. So, you know, so it's based, the point of it is to distill Ludwig von Mises' magnum opus, Human Action, which is
massive,
800 pages, something like that. And not only is it long, but Mises assumes a lot on the part of the reader. Like he's basically talking to a Renaissance man and then explaining the intricacies of what he calls praxeology. So it's certainly in my life, like besides the Bible, I think that book is the most influential in terms of my own life and worldview and everything. But it is difficult reading. And so David Thoreau, the president of the Independent Institute, approached me and said, hey, we have this idea for a project. There have been a couple of attempts to do this. No one's quite pulled it off. We want you to write something that's like 300-ish pages to distill Human Action down to one volume, assumes nothing prior on the part of the reader, and that the level of accessibility is a college student who's bright could get through this. Like that's what we want. And I said, okay. And that's what I tried to do. So that's what choice is. It's a standalone book. Like it's not a study guide, but it is based, it follows Human Action closely and tries to just, the big picture, what I did in there is I said, I want, by the time the reader puts this book aside, to understand Austrian business cycle theory. Like that was the main thing. But to do that, I ended up basically summarizing a lot of Human Action.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to give props to that book, because it was one of the ones that stuck with me in my early years. For I think I read Choice before. Oh, actually, now that I think about it, I don't think I've read all of Human Action. I think I've listened to a ton of the audiobook and read sections and chapters out of it, but I did read Choice. So I don't know which one I came across first, but it was but regardless, it was in that whole era. So I'll have the link in the show notes for anybody who wants to check that out. Is definitely recommended. So one thing you actually just said was that some of the MMTers that are actually open to the idea, or open to debate, I guess, were actually, that some of them were previously Austrian or at least Austrian leaning. How the hell do you go? How do you get that way? My process from MMT to Austrian economics made a lot of sense because it was just like realizing what it means to print money. Like, and I don't understand how you become an Austrian without understanding the dynamic there, that, you know, someone's consuming the resources and someone's writing stuff on paper. You know, what's their reasoning for going the opposite direction, so to speak?
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So it's, this guy's name is Douglas Roberts. So it's BobMurphyShow.com/291.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 291.
So that, just to take him as a specific example. So yeah, he went to an undergrad institution. I think Richard Ebling was a professor at the school he went to, who's a big, you know, Austrian guy, who was one of my teachers when I went through Hillsdale. That this is a different school. I think he switched. Ebling did. But yeah, I think where this particular guy, just to take him as an example, was coming from is, he understood the basic premises and whatever, but then later just came to believe, like, he's in investing now. And so he's been saying for years, hey, there's perma bears and you Austrians are always saying the world's going to end. You kept thinking it. And no, if people, you know, and so I didn't go back and like validate that he really was saying this in real time, but assuming, you know, I don't think he's lying, that, you know, saying no, you know, going into 2022, everyone was saying there's going to be a bad recession and we were looking at the numbers. So his point is, like, I don't even think he's necessarily, this is what I'm trying to say. There are some people who like the MMT analysis of this is just how the financial system works. And if you want to know like what's going to make the stock market go up, you know, your moralistic quibbles about fiat money or whatever, you know, you may be mm-hmm. right, you may be wrong. Maybe this is a terrible world, but this is the world we're in. And if you want to know when is the stock market going to go up and when is it going to go down, reading the MMT people is a lot better than just reading people who say, oh yeah, the dollar's going to crash because we went off gold in 71 or what. That's, you know, I'm distilling it down, but that's kind of where some of them are coming from. And so they just really do think. Now, having said that, there's the reason I'm so against MMT is because I think the movement as a whole, and especially like its prominent leaders like Stephanie Kelton in particular, are pushing that programs one. That I think yeah. are very bad, like, you know, Green New Deal and job guarantee provided by the federal government, stuff like that, that mm-hmm. I think would be, you know, the opening Pandora's box and then disaster. Giving people the thing, that, oh, don't worry, we can pay for it because we have a printing press. And mm-hmm. hey, if you know, if price inflation gets too high, then we'll you know, take our foot off the gas when, you know, since price inflation was the highest it's been since, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah. And Stephanie Kelton didn't say, okay, now's the time to take our foot off. Like, no, she was still, yeah, we can pay for stuff. What are you talking about? Haven't you read my book? So, yeah. You know, I think for some of them, like some of the prominent leaders, like the reason they're gaining such currency, no pun intended, among people is because it looks like, oh, here's the magic bullet to get these programs we've wanted our whole lives anyway. And, you know, this is our trump card to beat the fiscal hawks who say, well, how are we going to pay for that stuff? Because we have a printing press. Okay, but I'm saying there is a subset of the MMT people who, you know, they're not for those government programs, and it's just they're saying no in terms of me analyzing what causes recessions or blah blah blah, or you know, is QE going to be inflationary? You know, it's more nuanced than just well, gee, if you print money, then prices go up. So
yeah,
that's where some of them are coming. And so I'm saying I can kind of talk to those people, and we can, you know, we still disagree with each other about stuff, but it's more reasonable.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. You know, and there's like there's this weird disconnect between it's very much like an episode I had recently. I think it was The Guy's Take, but it was on a thread by Samantha Leduc, who is apparently a financial analyst. And I watched like a couple little things that she did just to kind of get some sort of perspective. But it's interesting, like she's in finance and she kind of has that the disease, not her, that misconception, I think, that because you're in and around money all the time, that you then understand money. Mm-hmm. And so she just starts applying all of this, like sort of market does this, market does that, sort of like surface level stuff to what is monetary technology, which is usually like 100-year time spans for shifts and important differences and stuff. You know, she's applying the wake at the top to the ocean, and it's just not the same thing. And that's one of the things that they have with like economics or whatever. Like I can kind of see if they're focused in the finance and investment side of things, that because it doesn't, like that's one of the things about Austrian economics to me, is that like you're never going to be able to see the whole picture. Like, you know, it's kind of use of knowledge in society sort of thing. It's like nobody has any idea what the whole thing is actually happening. So like QE isn't necessary. It's inflationary from the context of money, but it's not necessarily inflationary in the context of price, because if it's just trying to make sure that debt doesn't get wiped out, it's actually just it's just a protection against deflation. The inflation's already happened in the past when the credit was created, you know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So like, I get when somebody kind of sees the fundamental picture of Austrian economics and doesn't understand it in any more breadth, that they're going to predict that, oh, this is going to collapse, or we just printed $2 trillion and clearly there's going to be massive inflation. But that $2 trillion is just to prevent $2 trillion worth of default, which just means that the inflation from that credit is already here. And now we just made sure that that credit didn't disappear. So I guess that makes sense. But it's still it's a little surprising. I guess it's just not everybody even when they claim to be in a certain way. I mean, hell, I know plenty of libertarians who I wouldn't even consider libertarian. They think they are, mm-hmm. but not even close.
mm-hmm. Yeah. So just to follow up on what you're saying there, to be clear, I'm not, even the people that I'm cordial with, or where I still think they're wrong. So,
oh yeah,
but I'm just saying,
yeah,
we can get along with each other, and it's partly because it is more of an analytical disagreement as opposed to just a fundamental, you know, I want the government to take care of everybody and you don't. Mm-hmm. So therefore you're evil. So for example, and I think this kind of dovetails with what you're saying, that I think they have a very narrow, so, you know, their view is, well, of course, the government doesn't need tax revenue to function because the money comes from government deficits, right? Like mm-hmm. if you didn't have the government that first came in and deficit spent, how would we have any money? Because, you know, they're thinking of it in a very simplistic, like, accounting sense, mm-hmm. and how they can see, like, oh yeah, going from day to day right now, if the government runs a budget deficit, given our current system, there's a sense in which, yep, they're just kind of creating new money. And therefore, if you run it backwards, you'd think, oh, logically, there must have been a time zero when there was no money. And then fortunately, the government came on the scene and ran a deficit. Whew. And we just, you know what I mean? Like, so in the Austrian view, like, you just know that, no, that's just wrong historically. That's not what happened. You know, it was gold and silver and things were money. And then the government kind of came in and co-opted it and used a lot of coercion to do it, too. It wasn't that, oh, the country decided to go off gold because it was so inconvenient. No, FDR, you know, pointed guns at people and so forth. So things like that, or like a thing, if you want to mess up an MMT, or you just say, okay, well, Andrew Jackson paid off the national debt. So is that when there were no U.S. dollars in existence?
There was no money left, yeah.
Just to kind of show that, no, there's something wrong with your framework. But in any event, it's fun. But I think you're right that they're, and even in terms of, like, they have a lot of syllogisms and accounting tautologies. And so that's partly what I do, is I go in and get inside their framework and just show that
there's big holes.
They're able to tell their story with the accounting tautology, mm-hmm. but I can tell my story too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I was just showing it's not the accounting that's driving it. It's that they're using those particular relate. Like, once you know what the terms mean, it's a tautology. Okay. Yes, it's true, but mm-hmm. it can be very misleading. So that's why, you know, I do things like that also. Like, to give an example, so your listeners know what I'm talking about, they have a big thing saying, and Stephanie Kelton hammers this all the time, oh, everyone's all freaking out about the government debt, but the only way the private sector can accumulate net financial assets is if the government runs a budget deficit. And she even has a catchphrase saying, their red ink is our black ink. Okay? And so it's like flipping it on its head, and so most Austrians I know who go out there just say, like, oh yeah, let's just print money, idiot. It's, you know, fair enough. But that's sort of, you know what I mean? But if you're if you're one of Stephanie Kelton's fans, that sounds like you're running away from the claim.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, what I try to do is just to show, breaking it down and saying, okay, the logic they're using, by the same token, I could just draw an accounting boundary around, you know, IBM, and say, unless IBM issues bonds, the world minus IBM can't accumulate net financial assets.
Yeah.
And does that,
that's a good point.
Does that, you know, make anyone say, oh my gosh, all this whole time I've been worried about IBM issuing too much debt, but turns out the rest of us can't get
rich unless IBM does.
Yeah, And then the smart MMTer will try to call my bluff and be like, well, yeah, but the difference is private sector debt, you know, they can't print money. And so then I say, okay, so other things equal, if some entity owed you money, what's better for, you know, the community as a whole, if the only way they can come up with it to pay you off is to provide goods and services that everybody else values, because that's how a private sector person, you know, pays off their debt, or no, they can just stick guns in our bellies and take dollars from us and then say, oh, you know the money we owe you? Here you go.
Yeah.
Like, that's one way to go. Or just running the printing press that makes everything more expensive than it otherwise would be. Yeah. So that's what I mean. Like, just walking through and saying, sure, that, you know, your math is not wrong, but it doesn't mean what you think it means.
This show is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. My favorite setup, which I know I talk about a lot, is the Nunchuck Wallet on mobile. That just connects directly to, or just talks NFC whenever I need to sign. The Nunchuck does not hold my keys. It is securely on my cold card, not connected to the internet, not vulnerable to a phishing email or any malware or anything like that. If I ever need to send a transaction, I just create the transaction on my Nunchuck wallet and I tap it to my cold card. I hit sign, I tap it again, and then off it goes. There is no easier interface and way of interacting that grants a higher level of security, in my opinion, than that right there. It's genuinely incredible to me that we even have this capability in the Bitcoin space. And CoinKite has just made an entire suite of fascinating security and just fun Bitcoin devices and hardware products, like the block clock. Just connect it to your node and have it show the Bitcoin price, have it show the block height, just right there on your desk in this really cool package. If you haven't checked out what they have to offer, you definitely need to. And don't, when you go over there, do not forget that I have a 9% discount code. Bitcoin Audible, all one word, gets you 9% off. And you can go through the link in the show notes or just remember the discount code, which is not hard. It's just the name of the show. You can go through the link in the show notes to go right there or just go to the store, browse around, see what you want, get yourself a solid hardware wallet, experience the tap to send with a cold card hardware wallet. It's just kind of magical. And get notified for the Q1. I'm really stoked about my Cypherpunk BlackBerry, the new model that's going to be coming out. So check that out as well. Don't forget, 9% off. The link is right in the show notes. Go check them out.
Yeah, that was really the thing that, because the idea of money as a scoreboard, which was Warren Mosler, was kind of the rabbit hole we were going down during that time. And I thought he had some really intuitive arguments about that. And that was like eye-opening to me. And when we finally, it was probably Milton Friedman that was the first one that was like hitting arguments that were just like, damn. And, you know, he's not even technically an Austrian, but like very much in line with the kind of fundamentals, so to speak. Was realizing that, okay, if it's just a scoreboard, then what is it keeping score of? Because no, like there, if we're playing a game, then there's some sort of point to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're just manipulating the scoreboard, all we're doing is lying about what has happened in the game. So at the end of the day, money is supposed to put, like, let resources move around to the people who have contributed. Like, so that the people who are owed something, who have, you know, if I put a car's worth of value into the economic system, I should be owed a car back. The whole point is just to make sure that we're still growing things rather than just depleting everything. And like in the context of like IBM debt, you know, you say it's technically like three options. They can steal it from me or counterfeit the tokens, you know, counterfeit the unit, or they can actually provide me with computers. Well, from IBM, I just want the computers. I don't want to be stolen from, and I don't want the tokens to be counterfeited. But at the same time, you think about these are the two the same thing. It's just them using up the resources by counterfeiting the token and just not putting a gun to my head, but you've still just stolen the resources from the group, which so you can do it with the gun or the counterfeit. So it's two options, steal it or actually make something, you know? And like when kind of that clicked, I don't understand how I don't see how I could ever switch that off. You know what I mean? Like, how could I ever not see it that way again?
Yeah. And that's it dovetails, like you were saying with, you know, we talked about choice earlier, because to me that was, you know, the fundamental thing that Ludwig von Mises showed us was the function of what he called economic calculation. Mm-hmm. And so like, what is the social function of having private property and the use of money and market prices? And what good is accounting? You know, that sort of thing. And what's funny is a lot of people lately, arguments I've had in other matters, it seems like they think the point of accounting is to show the government how much you owe them at the end of the year. When no, like that's the sadistic use of it. But even in a free society, there would be accountants. There'd be a point to keeping your books and having double entry bookkeeping. But as Mises said, like to know at the end of a period, did we use resources efficiently or not? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that, and there's a real, you know, you need market prices to say that. So right, that connection to, you know, what is the function of it? And that once you realize that, as you say, okay, so then in the MMT framework, if there's this entity over here that can just print money willy-nilly, and the reason they enjoy that privilege is because they have guns. And the MMT people gleefully, like Warren Mosler, like he's very pleased with himself. He even does analogies. I had debated him once.
He has a great analogy on it.
Yeah, he has about, like he's saying, what if I want to get everyone in this room to do chores for me? Well, they're not going to do it. But what if I have a guy with a gun at the outside of the room that says the only way you can leave this room is if you give one of these tickets, you know, Warren Mosler tickets.
Yeah.
And that otherwise you can't leave the room. And if you try, he'll shoot you. And then all of a sudden people say, well, how do we get those tickets? And I say, well, why don't you go make me a sandwich and I'll give you a ticket. And why don't you go pick up that stuff over there? And I'll give you two tickets. And on the one hand, it's refreshing. Like they're not obfuscating and trying to dress it up and make it pretty or something. Like they're saying this is coming from the barrel of a gun. And then it's just the way the world is. And if you don't like it. So anyway, I'm just saying like it's got the strength and the weakness that, yes, at least he's being quite frank about what it is. But like you said, okay, but then you realize why that's the accounting and profits and so forth and the accumulation of net worth measured in money units, that scoreboard loses its significance if it's a different game. Just like if you scored a touchdown because, you know, you threw the ball to the guy and he dropped it, but then he picked it up and then the guys tried to tackle him and then he knifed them all and then goes into the end zone. He said, oh, 6 points right there. Touchdown. We're the best team ever. You know, people would say, no, you're breaking the rules. That's not how the game is supposed to be played. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that touchdown doesn't have the same social worth as if you hadn't done all that stuff. So anyway, I mean, I don't know if the analogy at this point is getting butchered, but I you're right that it is intriguing at first when I heard Moser talking about, for those who don't know, his point is like we said, how does the government pay for stuff? And it only hit, and he was saying, well, no, it's like the government can just print more money. And it's like the referees, you know, in a football game, if one team scores, it's not that the 6 points comes from somewhere. It's just it gets awarded.
Yeah.
And so that was the analogy. And when you first hear that, you're sort of back on your heels, like, well, how do I deal with that? But I think you hit the nail on the head that it's we're playing a different game if you do it that way. And in which case, the points don't have the same prestige as they do in the game that everyone else thinks they're playing.
Yeah. Yeah. If the goal of, football or whatever it is to get people to strategize within a set of rules, work together as a team, and then play excellent football, you have completely destroyed that. Like everything about that is out the window when you introduce the, oh, this team's not got enough tall players, so we're going to give them 20 points to start off with. And this team, you know, yeah, they dropped the ball, but they're the important team. And so sure, he knifed the other guy, but you know, he did get across the touchdown. Like as soon as you start doing that, there's nothing about football. There's nothing about teamwork. In fact, now everybody's going to hate each other. And all anybody's actually going to spend any time doing is, you know, trying to suck off the referees to make sure that they're the ones that get all the extra points and all the free stuff and complain. And the whole industry is going to stop from doing what they actually need to do, which is playing good football or, you know, making food and housing and all of those things. And they're just going to gather around this political class and just figure out how can I just please them and do whatever they want so that I can get the points and just use up everybody else's stuff.
And maybe one other point to add is the MMT worldview, it consumes itself. It's like it sows the seeds of its own destruction because they all acknowledge, oh, the only groups that can pull this off right now are so-called monetary sovereigns, meaning governments that can issue debt denominated in their own currency. And, you know, there's a global market for that. So like, you know, the US with the dollar and European nations and, you know, Japan. So it's not that, you know, some tiny little country somewhere can just practice MMT. I mean, it's not that the MMT framework is wrong for them. They would just say, oh, they're not monetary sovereigns. So that's why, you know, they basically follow gold standard rules.
Yeah.
And so the irony with that is, okay, even on its own terms, if U.S. policymakers followed Stephanie Kelton's advice, pretty soon global investors would not take treasuries the way they do right now. And the dollar would not be even though it's shrinking, but would, you know, it would forfeit its reserve status even faster. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, we would no longer be, the U.S. government would no longer be a monetary sovereign, at which point 70 gallons say, oh, okay, yeah, now deficits matter. But, you know, I'm talking about back when the dollar was king, and it's like, right, and it's because they listened to your advice that it.
I'm curious, man. What's kind of your take on the state of things? Maybe both from a monetary perspective in the context of, like, we've had, you know, an aggressive run of like increased interest rates in, you know, 21 and 22. And I guess it's mostly stable in 23, or maybe it started out with some hikes. But it looks like maybe not. I don't know. It's always hard to say. Like, that's one of those things, you know, Austrians get pegged for a lot, is that it always looks like everything's on the edge of collapse, but mm-hmm. the thing is so big and so complex and has so many moving parts. And when you have fiat currencies all over the world that are in these debt crises and like just bloated beyond belief, well, losing 10% is better than losing 40%. So you may actually see the network of the negative 10% grow rather than fall, you know, despite the fact that all else equal, negative 10% is a disaster in the context of, you know, losing money in your currency. Mm-hmm. So what would you say, what do you see right now that's most interesting in the context of like maybe the state of the economy and where kind of the debt and inflation is likely to go in your estimation in the next couple of years, maybe?
Okay. So, and this was a specific thing that that guy, Douglas Robert, and I debated on my show, the episode mm-hmm. we talked about earlier. So a big thing I've been focusing on in the last few years is the inverted yield curve. And mm-hmm. so I think it dovetails nicely with standard Austrian theory about what caused the business cycle. But strictly speaking, the inverted yield curve is like an indicator, you know, leading indicator of an impending recession. That's not an Austrian hobby horse. That, you know, that's a kind of yeah. well-respected mainstream thing since the 80s, at least. And what I think is going to happen is the Fed is going to keep rates steady, and then the economy at some point is going to start getting worse and worse. We're in a weird situation right now where the indicators do not all line up together, right? There's some things mm-hmm. you can look at, like, oh, gee, unemployment and GDP, official GDP growth, as we're recording this guy, you know, the report just came out either yesterday or the day before about the last quarter. And, mm-hmm. oh, it's still 3.3% or something. Oh, that's pretty good. But yet a lot of people really think, no, something is screwed up with the economy. Like, this doesn't feel right. And I'm nervous. The Biden people try to make it sound like, oh, that's just Fox News filling you with fear. When they think, like, no, I've been going to the grocery store and it's tough. And, I'm not making this up. So I think what's going to happen is that at some point, you know, as things continue to soften, to use a, you know, cliche or a euphemism, the Fed will see an impending recession. They'll start cutting. And then that means the inverted yield curve will uninvert as short rates come back down below long rates. Mm-hmm. And then historically, you know, since the 60s, that's never had been a false indicator that when the yield curve has been as, and this is the deepest and longest inversion possibly since World War II, but it's definitely in the last several one. So I think, put it this way, if the yield curve, when it finally goes back to normal and upward sloping, if there's no recession, that's going to be a big deal. That's going to be an anomaly that will have to be explained. So that's, you know, partly why I think that's what's going to happen. So I think they're going to hold steady for a bit and then start cutting. But what's interesting mm-hmm. is they have painted themselves into a corner that yeah. if, you know, they sort of, it was, you know, during the QE rounds, guys like Peter Schiff and me looked foolish because we had been warning about, uh-oh, this is Bernanke's crazy. He's opened up the floodgates, get ready for the dollar. And that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want a minute, we can talk about why made that. But since the, you know, 2020 and what they did the same playbook, except more so. And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, prices went way up and it turns out printing money does make things get more expensive. Okay. And so that, you know, they're sort of it as painting themselves into a corner where, yeah, they don't, if the economy starts weakening, their inclination will be to open up the monetary spigots again and loosen. But on the other hand, it's harder to do that if CPI is running hot, whereas that, you know, that wasn't mm-hmm. the case in 2010, 2011. And so I think, you know, they're up against that. So to answer your question, I think a bad recession is coming. I think they're going to actually cut rates ahead of that, seeing the weakness. And then, you know, because I think they don't want there to be a bad recession before this next upcoming election. They don't want to give more to Trump, who may be running from prison at that point. You know, that would be my prediction for that. Longer term, again, I think the dollar keeps losing its international prestige. You know, and I've quantified this stuff too. Like I wrote something recently. Yeah. So that it's called The Coming Displacement of the Dollar, November 2023 in Chronicles. So if you just Google my name, Chronicles Dollar, you'll probably find it. And I just go through and document and just say that it's, you know, like, in other words, yes, gold bug types since the early 70s have been saying, oh, the end is near. And they keep looking full of it. but just I document use various statistics to show like the percentage of the U.S. dollar in foreign exchange reserves has been steadily declining.
Yeah. That really started in 2013, 2014. Really? Am I right? Excuse me.
I mean, in terms of a short-term trend, yeah. But I looked at like I think longer, like from 2000 onward or something.
Okay,
just showing
okay.
It's been, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like a linear. Like it's not that every day it falls the same amount, but you get what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Like over time, and things like the amount of debt that foreign U.S. dollar denominated debt that foreigners are holding, it's not that that's falling in absolute terms necessarily, but it surged and then they were done. And then the government kept running, our government kept running bigger deficits. So things like that, if you look at even the official reports about how much gold, like the BRICS countries are stockpiling.
Yeah.
And I have some people who are telling me like Dominic Frisby's one who's done where he thinks that the Chinese numbers are way understated. He thinks the Chinese are deliberately hiding from the world how much gold they're accumulating because they don't want to cause a panic. They just want to kind of quietly do it in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these people who are going, oh, dollar's king, dollar's, it doesn't matter whether we run trillion plus dollar deficits year after year, no big deal, because what else are you going to do? I think that's extremely short-sighted. And so, stuff with the Bitcoin ETF and just the work we do here at Infinio, I'm talking with more international investor types than I used to when I was just arguing stuff, libertarianism on Twitter with people,
where
I had more of an America-centric focus. And yeah, I think the U.S. as a whole is just going to recede in prominence, and that it's not going to be a superpower 20 years from now. I think it's going to be a multipolar world. Not that China's running the world, but I don't think that it's going to be the U.S. empire anymore. I think they have squandered that with their foolish decisions, both fiscally, monetarily, and militarily. I think you're going to see a shift away. If they were smart, I'm not saying they're going to do this, but like the BRICS, they should back their currencies with gold.
Yeah.
Or Bitcoin, depending on if the adoption rates, if that becomes
something provable, something verifiable. Yeah.
If they wanted to do that. So I don't know if they are going to do that or not, because that ties their hands too. Like there's a reason governments don't like hard
China
money.
China has a debt problem too. Yeah.
But if they wanted to hasten the demise of the dollar and the displacement of it, that's what they would do.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'm answering. So I think there's a bad recession coming in the short term, and then long term, I think the U.S. dollar is especially. It's the kind of thing where everything might seem fine, and then it's going to be quick. That if the spell is broken and a bunch of people around the world suddenly lose faith in the dollar, you're going to see a lot of metaphorically like a lot of dollars coming home. And then prices rising here, because it's like the flip side of for decades, the U.S. has been
exporting
effectively. Paper. Yeah. Like instead of sending just wheat and whatever, we just send $100 bills and people send us cars and computers and sweaters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a good deal from our point of view. Well, we just give you some digits electronically and you send us stuff. That's kind of good. But you're going to see the reverse of that, if that spell is broken.
Swan Bitcoin has the full suite of Bitcoin financial services. You can instantly buy, with your bank account or wire transfer, any amount of Bitcoin up to $10 million worth. And you can easily set up what I have been doing for ages, which is an automatic purchase of Bitcoin on a weekly or monthly basis. You just pick your time frame and then automatically withdraw it to your cold storage. And still they have free withdrawals to self-custody, which I was sure would be gone by now. But you should always treat any custodian as a point of failure. And luckily, you won't have to go anywhere for all of the information and advice you need for why you should withdraw and how to do it safely, because Swan Bitcoin has all of the resources you need and will regularly remind you. About 80% or more of their customers automatically withdraw their coins. That is an amazing feat, if you ask me. Then they also have the Swan IRA if you have a traditional IRA and you want to get it allocated to Bitcoin. And there's so much more. With Swan Private, they have inheritance planning. You also have Swan business accounts, and you can even do Bitcoin as a part of your employee benefit plans. They have an advisory. They have the Swan Vault, a multi-sig service for those who want to have the benefits of holding the majority of their keys, but still also want to be able to rely on a trusted institution in the case of an emergency or a disaster. If you haven't started into Bitcoin yet, Swan is an amazing place to begin. Go to swan.com/guy. The link will be right there in the description. Again, that is swan.com/guy. And they will know that I sent you, and my beautiful face will be right there at the top of the page to greet you. I am a longtime user myself, and a huge thank you to Swan for supporting this show. And I definitely recommend you check them out.
Yeah, that's a big thing on like price inflation is remembering that the size and strength of the network. Like one of the analogies that I use for just trying to make sense of like what money is that it's like a network good. You know, it's very much like the phone or the English language more than it is like wheat or a hammer. Mm-hmm. In the sense that, you know, if you're the only one with a phone, doesn't matter if it's the most revolutionary technology on the planet, it's useless. Mm-hmm. If you're the only one who speaks English, doesn't matter if it's a good, complicated, nuanced language, whatever the heck it is, you can't communicate with anybody. That's its only purpose. Mm-hmm. In that sense, when you're trying to make sense of price inflation versus monetary inflation, is you have to see what's happening to the network. Because right now we have a global network. And as you say, and this actually, the coming displacement of the dollar or whatever, it's probably something just like laying out the data on it. Lynn Alden has a good piece on this, actually. It's absolutely like if anybody's looking at the trend and just projecting out like how things are and what decisions can even be made, you know, like America was probably peaked in the 90s. And ever since then, it's basically been in gradual and a relatively steeper decline from the context of political stability, from the context of like how many people are buying our bonds and actually want our debt. And when that happens, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. Like our network, we could get massive inflation even if we were like, we had no deficit whatsoever, just by the global network all coming home to roost. Mm-hmm. You know, just by other countries making the decision, which who knows, but probably China will do it, and then we'll call it economic terrorism and we'll go to war
Yeah.
But if their dollars just left China and came back to the US without printing any money, we'd have massive inflation. Because we have it was just like there was an old story about it was a country in kind of the Constantinople era, I think. But it was something about like some country went and like took over another country and took just a massive amount. They just had like a huge amount of gold. Mm-hmm. And they brought it back, and there was literally inflation in gold because they just brought so much new gold into the network, and they thought they were wealthy. I mean, you know, to some degree they were, but it also just caused a massive devaluation in gold because of how much the amount mm-hmm. of units in the network exploded in such a short amount of time. With that, I mean, I think you're entirely right, but I'm eager to actually get down to the nit and gritty of what that argument looks like. But it seems pretty obvious to me from so many different ways that we're headed into a multipolar world. And I don't see, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, it's going to be China, and, you know, the BRICS nations are going to take over and replace NATO for the people who are kind of like in that perspective. Mm-hmm. But I'm not so sure. It seems like there has, I mean, maybe it's benefit of hindsight that, you know, since we've always just kind of been declining empire, rising empire, mm-hmm. There seems to be this inability or disconnect in like that sort of cohesion that history seems to have, you know. And then especially with the introduction of Bitcoin, like I know for a lot of people in the traditional world, it looks like a toy, but like this is like fundamental infrastructure. You know, this is a consensus technology about how do you do joint accounting with people who don't trust each other so that neither can cheat. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. that is a global breakthrough. You know, like that's a phenomenal, like phenomenally impactful technology. The birth of triple entry accounting, essentially. And with that sort of thing, like the monetary power has always been the violent power. like throughout history. And it's because the one who's most violent is their debt's the most trustworthy, because as you say, they could just go and get it. Mm-hmm. But in a world where that might be threatened in the digital space, I don't quite see how we have anything other than kind of like just this kind of volatile back and forth between who's the most productive. And if nobody can actually cheat the ledger, like let's say we get to a Bitcoin future, or we get mm-hmm. to a sound money future again, the possibility of a global economy, a global network, and a sound money. It seems unlikely to me. I don't know. Maybe it's just my bias. What do you think about that? Are we moving into a new empire, or do you see more of a multipolar future?
Definitely multipolar. So I think you're right that when I make arguments about, I think the dollar is not going to be the global reserve currency, da, 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 and a lot of the arguments to show why I'm wrong is they're basically just saying, they're giving me reasons that the Chinese yuan can't do the job. And that, yep. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, yep. They're assuming there has to be a global reserve currency that's issued by a sovereign government mm-hmm. that's fiat. And they're just saying right now it's the dollar, and what else could it be? And that's kind of their argument. And so I think that, no, you're assuming the conclusion there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, right. As you say, I think, you know, the US empire is collapsing, and I think at this point, states are probably going to break up in the not too distant future. I think Texas, you know, maybe the vanguard in that. And so that's certainly going to weaken the prestige of the US dollar for whatever remnant of the current US regime is, you know, still has a tax base and whatnot. But yeah, I don't necessarily see that. I mean, it's, say what you will, but there's still officially a bunch of commies running China. So communism is, you know what I mean? Like, even like, oh, it's not real communism. Oh, okay. But even, like, artificial communism is not too good. So both morally and, you know, economically speaking. So, you know, I don't expect them taking over, but mm-hmm. what I think is coming, because I'm also big on AI, like in terms of things. And I mm-hmm. think it's good, like the year 2050, it's not even going to be what we consider now nation states. I think it's going to be more multinational corporations that have like warehouses of supercomputers running the most advanced, you know, AI systems. And they're all like half of the competition occurs in the digital plane. And mm-hmm. then, you know, like, and yeah, and like the computational power in the Bitcoin network at that point would just blow us away. And they're all competing, you know, to get the fees, where to add the next block. And that's, you know, revenue streams for all these giant behemoth things that are like, from our point of view, it's almost like a merging of the human board, the board members in terms of the direction of what this enterprise, which direction are we taking it? But then the computers that kind of run it day to day in terms of the implementation of it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, like those are going to be the various power centers, not the government of Brazil. Or that's good. Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to be like the mayor in our current system of some town is the way I'm picturing it. So, that's kind of what I think is what we're going to see.
Have you ever read, is there more to the title, or is it just called The Network State? Crap. It's Balaji Srinivasan's book. And I don't agree with him on a lot of things. But he does such a good job of like painting pictures and seeing things from a really high kind of like demographic point of view, kind of like Peter Zion does, except that I also think his monetary perspective is ridiculous, but he has a really great demographic perspective. Balaji has a book called, it's something, The Network State. It might just be called The Network State, but I think the picture that he paints, and something that I like what you said is, the government, the federal government will be kind of like the mayor now, mm-hmm. is, you know, when we went through the Renaissance, and, you know, before that, the technology that enabled it, the printing press and the explosion of literacy in the 16th century. And suddenly the monopoly on ideas of the church just was eviscerated in about 100 years. And in doing so, there was this explosion of interpretation of the Bible, of interpretation of values and meaning. The scientific revolution followed, like everything happened during that era, basically. And it fundamentally changed. It, you know, came along with 100 rebellions and reshaping of all the countries and borders all over the place. And one of the interesting things is that the church went from the power, because they were the ones who interpreted the will of God, and God just so happened to always say, you should be in charge, is it went from that to the church. Now, the church is still powerful. The church is still relevant as a political entity, but the church is not the ruler. And I'm inclined to think that this is actually part of the transition that we're going through. When you have a global communication mechanism that is external to a power structure, where the authority does not decide how communication moves, but the people at the bottom can, you know, in a matter of an hour, somebody can say something provocative and it can get retweeted from their trusted network into their trusted network into their trusted network, and 20 million people can see it and have their minds changed. Like, that's groundbreaking. And when it's on a global level, you know, there's only so many lies that actually stand up between, you know, Israel and Pakistan, between Russia and the US, like whatever conflict there is. They used to have a total chokehold on what people thought about whatever war was going on, because they controlled the reins. They controlled all of the bandwidth for what people were able to see and get exposed to. They don't anymore. And fundamentally, even though they're trying to get that chokehold back, it's failing. I mean, we're figuring out ways around them before they even get done censoring. Like we're using Nostr and Keet. I'm not sure if you know how much you get into the tech, real techie stuff, but they're peer-to-peer, decentralized, like relay-based networks. They're like working phenomenally. Like, I'm all day on Keet and it's entirely peer-to-peer. It's crazy. Essentially applications built on BitTorrent. But the bandwidth around them is just going to explode, which means that I think we're moving into what Balaji theorizes or whatever, is that we're moving into a network state, which is similar, kind of similar to what you were talking about, just kind of in the idea of more corporations and large entities, but more that like the rules of the network and communication online in the digital space will actually guide how communities are built and maintained. And essentially outside of that, that will actually be the bulk of the power. And the federal government will just kind of be this figurehead. It's like the king and queen. You know, they're there. They're powerful. They have some money. But what do they mean really in the context of day-to-day life? Mm. And that trend is going to continue. And you're right. AI is a huge kind of just like wrench in this whole thing of like, this is just going to accelerate everything on a whole nother level. And I'm not sure how interested you are in that, but I actually have it's funny you bring it up, because I have another podcast about AI, because it has a lot of the same problems of Bitcoin and crypto or whatever, just being full of nonsense. But there's a nugget of like, holy crap, like this is actually huge. Anyway, long rant, but it's mostly to say I agree, but I really like Balaji's theory on the idea that we're going to be organized by networks. In the next 20 to 30 years, is going to reshape how we think of as governance and the organization of humankind. And it's going to be global and will be disparate among the same geography, if you get my meaning.
Yeah. So a lot there. So for Balaji, it's funny, a coworker at Infinio like 4 months ago or so was just really saying, Bob, you got to check this guy out. He's great. You know, I listen to your stuff, Bob, you'd love him. And I opened the tab and it was like a 4-hour podcast. And I was like, I'm not going to listen. And so I said, okay. And it sat there for 2 months. And then I was like, you know what? I told a guy I'd listen to. Let me go ahead. And I'm in my car. And I was coming up with reasons to keep going to the store, to keep driving around, because I couldn't.
Just so you could get to the end of it.
Right. I couldn't. he just kept talking. And like, I was like, oh, yeah. You know, and I loved him in particular because it dovetails with what I was saying about the decline of the U.S. empire. He just started documenting all the recent examples of countries, like the U.S. government said, hey, we'd really like it if you did such and such. And they were like, okay, noted. We're not going to do that. But thank you for your input. And they just went and did their thing. And his point was, it's not that they're anti-U.S. It's just, no, we're going to make our decisions about stuff that has nothing to do with Washington, D.C. And what are you going to do? And Washington's like, yeah, they're right. Maybe 10 years ago in the Clinton administration or something, we would have done something, but we kind of are spread thin at this point because we made a lot of bad decisions the last 20 years. So we're not going to do anything. And like, as more and more countries see that that's what happens, like, oh, so we don't have to just do whatever the heck some U.S. senator says. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, like things like that. And but beyond, as you say, like everything he was bringing up, like I was, oh, yeah, not that I agreed with every last sentence of that came out of his mouth. But yeah, I was he's I haven't read his book that you alluded to. But no, I just the limited amount I've listened to him. I think, yeah, he's really tracking and has a very fresh perspective. He's not just like, yeah. Oh, he's like these three other guys I follow put together. No, he's his own thing.
He is his own beast. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I recommend it. You would probably really enjoy that. And you know, there's a degree too. It's crazy how quickly these things can snowball. Mm-hmm. Because you're talking about social dynamics rather than some sort of technical understanding. You know, so you get into the idea of, you know, network feedback and virality of like perspective. And so like one of the things is it's like that experiment or thought experiment, whatever you want to call it, of the social permission. It's everybody's been doing what the U.S. says because, you know, the U.S. had a habit of going in and bonking people on the head when they didn't. And they had succeeded at that for a long time. But now we're entering this phase where it's becoming obvious that the U.S. is stretched so thin that they don't really have that power anymore. And they certainly can't do it at scale. So as soon as someone says, no, we're not going to do that, and the U.S. makes a big stink about telling them what they should do, and then they mm-hmm. don't do it, it's like that social permission. You know, when you're at an intersection or whatever, and everybody's waiting for the light to turn so that you can walk across the mm-hmm. intersection, and there's no cars anywhere, but the light won't turn, mm-hmm. and everybody's just kind of standing around. It's like, what are we doing? And then one person just says, screw it, I'm going to walk. And then in moments, the whole mm-hmm. crew follows behind. It's like, I think we're going to see that moment when it comes to everybody just, I'm not going to do what the U.S. says anymore. You know, I'm not inclined to care at this point. And how quickly that can get away from things, especially when the future seems clearly in American decline, is something that seems pretty obvious on the chart. But in that same vein, you know, talking about multipolarity, balkanization, that sort of thing, you specifically brought up Texas. I have been trying to be healthy and stay off of Twitter more recently. So I'm actually only very loosely aware of what's going on. And I saw you tweet something about it yesterday, and I retweeted it about like, can we at least agree that the federal government shouldn't go kill American citizens over this? Mm-hmm. Can you give me the breakdown? Because as I understand it, something's going to happen today. There's like a or else happening right now. Can you kind of give for any of the audience who has also tried to be healthy and stay off of social? What the hell is happening here and how significant do you think this is?
Okay, so the context for my interest in this issue is mm-hmm. I think 2.5 years ago at this point, I released a pamphlet called Common Sense, the Case for an Independent Texas. And so that's PDF. If you want to look that up, it's free.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just going through and, you know, making the arguments as to why I thought, because I've always been, you know, since I've been a libertarian, thought people had the right, of course, to, hey, if you don't want to be part of some larger political organization, you should have the right of self-determination. You know, that's kind of what Thomas Jefferson said. If we see some other government cracking down on people trying to break away, we get mad at them. So why not apply that same logic to Americans? If you know, a group wanted to break away, they should be able to. But I didn't really care much about it. And then it was just with all the culture war stuff of recent years, I thought the only way, ironically, to avoid a civil war is if some groups are allowed to break away and we can all self-sort. And the people who really can't stand, you know, CNN and the blue state regime and abortion, they can all move to the state that breaks away, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. So recently that has very quickly come to a head. I don't claim guy by any stretch to be an expert, but I think the basic story is that, you know, people have been talking about, oh, wow, the flood of illegals coming in. And it's crazy. Like they're putting them on planes, people without even ID, putting them on U.S. flights and flying them all over. In New York City, they had to go to at-home schooling because the immigrants coming in who like needed to be housed somewhere, they put them in the school. Like that's where they were sleeping and stuff. And so they told the students, we're going to, you know, like
well, how would COVID, your kids COVID get an days. Education without taxes?
Right. And in O'Hare Airport, I believe, like there were whole mm-hmm. terminals, you know, cordoned off and, oh no, the flights have all been redirected because we're housing, you know, people here. Where are we going to put them? So, I mean, just nutty stuff. And so the governor of Texas, like they said, okay, well, if the feds aren't enforcing the border, then we will. And they put a barbed wire and they had the National Guard. And then the Biden administration had federal troops, not the right word, personnel, let's call them, mm-hmm. go and start cutting down the barbed wire. And then Governor Abbott of Texas ordered the Texas National Guard, don't let them do that. Put it back up. And so it was kind of a, you know, and the feds were outgunned. And so they could, you know, they didn't do that. And then the Supreme Court recently, I didn't go in and parse the rule, but the way it's being reported, let's assume, is that mm-hmm. they were saying, no, Texas, you do not have the constitutional authority to do that. Stop doing that. The you know, immigration is a federal responsibility. We, you know, the federal government is in charge of the national border with mm-hmm. Mexico. You can't do that. Stand down. And Governor Abbott said, no, I'm not standing down. And so this, you know, this is, oh, this is, and then a bunch of other states now have been saying, like, we stand with Texas and, like, issuing formal proclamations. And so people are, like, drawing maps and I'm making mm-hmm. obvious allusions to the Civil War and, you know, some wise guys. These states should form, you know, a confederation, says, you know, of unified, you know, that kind of stuff. So
I've got an idea.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm very alarmed by how, and the last thing you said is that, yes, the Biden administration gave them a deadline. As you and I are recording, it's today. So we'll see when we log off what happened. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like Abbott's going to back down. And so, mm-hmm. okay, so what happens now? But again, the interesting thing is that it's not a matter of, oh, well, because they have slavery. It's that, no, they're enforcing like standard immigration law and the federal government is not. And, you know, yeah. So it's a weird situation.
They're both just enforcing the law as it's actually supposed to be, one. And then two, they're protecting their own land. You know, it's like me putting a fence around my yard and then having the city come up and be like, because the city is paying to pump people into my yard and take stuff or just be a burden mm-hmm. on, you know, because we have this stupid system where like we can't be a benefit to each other. Every new person is just another mouth to feed. And I'm not allowed to put up, I'm not allowed to just keep people out of my yard according to the law that says I should, you know? Mm-hmm. Like it's just, it's so crazy.
To give one more data point, yeah. Guy, on this is, so I'm friends with Daniel Miller, who's the head of the Texas Nationalist Movement.
Okay.
And the last time I interviewed him, he told me they had gotten the requisite number of petitions for the Republican primary ballot in Texas. So not the, to be clear, not the, you know, the election in November, sure. But when Texas has its, I think it's in March, when mm-hmm. they have their primary vote, the GOP version, that on that they wanted to put an item about Texas secession. And, you know, so it wouldn't be binding. Like it's just a, you know,
oh, yeah,
but,
sure.
But he said he said, according to them, that there's some provision in something that was passed in the 80s about if you want to get an item on the primary ballot, you just need to get these non-signatures. And he said, we went and did that and we submitted it. And that the state level GOP said, no, because some of these are electronic. And, you know, and Miller tells mm-hmm. me that, no, clear reading the statute, that's fine. These are admissible. And then I asked him, you know, well, what's the problem? And he said, because they know it would overwhelmingly pass, that they've done, you know, poll. And it's not just their own internal polling that could be biased. He's saying like outside groups that have no dog in the fight mm-hmm. are reporting that, you know, and I don't remember what the margin, but he was saying he thinks it would be a landslide.
Wow.
Among GOP voters.
Among the, yeah.
Yeah, voting in the primary to say yes. And I don't remember the exact wording, like to say, should we consider it or should it be an issue or like literally let's leave. But mm-hmm. in any event, so there's lots of these currents in motion where
it's meaningful. It's a meaningful social signal, so to speak.
A couple of years ago when I published that, you know, it's still, I knew it was an issue and I wanted to like start the conversation, partly because I thought let's go through these logistics and hammer this stuff out when there's not a crisis at the door. Like, because mm-hmm. then that's when things get violent and people get hot headed. Like, let's think about it orderly that So I don't like how it's being rushed because of this confrontation. You know, I would have rather the people of Texas, if it were going to happen, just went through normal democratic procedures and voted just in terms of legitimacy, and it'd be hard at any point to say, oh, now's the point we should start dropping bombs on Dallas. If they were, you know what I mean? But here, if, you know, if some federal personnel gets shot by Texas, you know, that's not going to be good.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. It's going to be, it's crazy too. Like how, like it could be something that innocuous or that small that sets a lot in motion, especially when pressures are as high as they are. And, you know, it was, everybody's like, oh, World War One was started by the assassination of one person. It's like, no, it was 20, 30 years of monetary pressures, impossible debts, tensions rising, disparate. You're definitely going to pay for my deficits, you know, like infighting. And then, you know, that one spark just lit the tinder. So it's arguable to say that things are divisive enough that, you know, if people are killed over this, like American citizens are killed over this, that it could get out of hand. That it could be a really, really messy, I mean, hell, just that is a messy thing, without a doubt, but who knows how bad it gets. We live in a weird time.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the tweet that you alluded to, that's partly what I'm doing right now, is just to say, hey, before this goes down, can we all agree it should not be the case that people in Washington give orders to start slaughtering U.S. civilians who live in Texas over something that the, you know, Governor Abbott may decide. And most people are taking it, but I do have some people pushed back and saying, no, that's true them, you know. But partly I'm doing it because people are bringing up Waco. It's like, so yeah, it's not that the federal officials are, reticent of killing a bunch of people in Texas. That, but I think like with Waco, if someone had said on the front end, hey, if there's allegations of child abuse, what if we just like burn the whole place to the ground and use chemical weapons that have been banned in international warfare? Is that cool? Everyone said, no, that's crazy. But then since it happened, then after the fact, Americans are very good about, well, I'm sure there must have been a good reason they did that.
You know, there must have been a good reason that they killed the kids that were being abused that they claim and didn't have evidence of. But okay.
So that's what I'm trying to get people, well, still hypothetical, to agree. Yeah, of course we wouldn't send tanks in just because some people voted for self-determination like Thomas Jefferson said they could. You know, because if it happens after the fact, then everyone's going
to
rationalize it.
Then it's done. You won't be able to... You need something to pinpoint, you know, to go back to. It's like, no, remember, you thought this was crazy before it happened. Right. Now you're just back excusing everything that already occurred. It's really nuts. Listen, we're over an hour. How good are you on time? I know I could go for another little while, but I don't want to take up your time.
I should probably wrap within like 5 minutes if we can.
Okay.
If you have like a little topic you want to bring up.
You know what, on that, you know, maybe we'll keep it here. Like whether or not we're headed toward escalation, or maybe this is just another little blip. You know, there's been some like random conflicts, like little things, you know, over the last couple of years that have led to the tensions. But I would say, if like for the audience, what do you see as the most important thing happening over the next year? And then what do you see as the most important trend over the next decade? On the spot.
Right. Okay. So next decade, I really do think AI, and I want to be clear, I'm not talking about like, oh, there's this one thing and it's going to take over the world. That's not what I mean. Even if GPT-4 were the ceiling of how developed these large language models get, just the adoption, the proliferation, and at the Infinio podcast that I host, I had a guy on recently, and his thing was, think of it like this. Right now, all the different devices you have or whatever, they have different communication styles. If it's the point where every device at least can just speak French, then they can all communicate that way. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, oh yeah, my human person wants me to go get this data set. And then the other one's like, oh, we got it in CSV, but they're speaking to each other in English or French. And you know what I mean? Like things like that. Like, it's really just showing how the world is going to be so much different as this stuff gets adopted and gets incorporated into everything we're doing. So I think over the next 10 years, that is probably going to be the biggest source of
the wild card.
How people right now thinking 10 years from now and picturing the world, if they're not having there just be a trillion bots in the digital plane interacting with each other, then I think they're missing a big component of what's going on. It's almost like we're going to be visited by aliens.
Yeah.
that maybe aren't more intelligent than us. I'm not saying that, you know what I mean? But that can have a conversation with us. And that would be pretty significant if there's
but
a trillion aliens.
But they have a market, a conversation, a system, you know, et cetera. Yeah.
So that short term, I'm not sure what the thing in Texas, like I said, I hope that dies down. I don't know what's going to go on with this election. I mean, I don't think they're going to want Trump to be the next president, and they're just going to keep doing various things. And I know I'm being very America centric, but I actually do think that's going to be a pretty big.
No, that matters. Moment,
100%. As far as the fate of the U.S. empire, and there's a lot riding on that. So I don't think they're going to let him be the next president, and the way that situation unfolds could have a lot to do with, you know, states breaking away and things like that,
increasing the pressure and making things potentially violent. No, I agree. Election years are never fun. It's like, it's just, oh God. So the last vote I ever cast was for Ron Paul in the primary. And I am probably going to keep it that way. Vivek almost had me think like, okay, if there's a small chance, maybe that's worth it just for the, like, you know what, let's just have somebody that thinks all of this is ridiculous. And it's just like, at least open to talk about it and shut people down in the media. But other than that, nah, it's just a spectator sport for me at this point. Holy crap. It is a mess. You know, when you have a government that just runs $4 trillion, $5 trillion worth of the economy, I don't understand how people call this a free market when, like, it seems so obvious that, like, we don't really have control over the direction of anything. You know, like the money printer, the government, and everybody screaming about who's going to be directing all of this capital in this way or the other. Just seems like it's like that's what we got.
And like you said, whatever this system is and the result it produces, people say that's free market capitalism. We don't like that. It's like, say what you will. No, that's not free market capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, dude, thank you. Thank you for coming on. I'm not even sure if you saw, but I did one of your articles recently, the whether or not static money supply can work. I can't remember the name of the title, the title of the article. But I actually read that on the show and did I did a guy's take on it. And you said you had Owen Benjamin in an interview that's going to be coming out. Did you?
It just posted yesterday.
You're supposed to be yesterday. Let me get the link for that too, because I'm actually curious about that. I came really close to inviting him on, but I was just like so exhausted with it. I don't know if I care, but I would listen to yours.
Yeah, he's a force of nature. I listened to it myself again last night, like in it. I don't know what else I could have done. So I understand a lot of where he's coming from. He certainly, I share his disgust with the current American culture.
Yeah.
And then it's just, I think the way he's trying to analyze like his solution, I think is backwards. Yes. But that, you know, that's kind of my takeaway. But yeah, if you go to BobMurphyShow.com, it's the most recent interview.
All right. I'll make sure I have that in there. Thank you again for coming on. And is there anything else you want to share? I mean, I guess direct people to Bob Murphy Show.
Sure. Whatever. Yeah. My podcast, BobMurphyShow.com. I have a different, more financial AI blockchain stuff at infineo.ai. If people go that, it's infineo.ai. And on Twitter, I'm Bob Murphy Econ, where you can see my hijinks.
Awesome. Dude, thank you so much. And I might reach out to you again if you're up for it. I'd love to do another show, especially maybe after a year goes by and we have a lot more of this to unpack.
Yeah, maybe I'll be broadcasting from the Republic of Texas.
Yeah. Hey, that's right. Awesome, dude.
Okay. Thanks for having me. And I appreciate the work you've been doing. Like I say, I realize it's an important topic, and you know, you talking to innovators in this field is good. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, man. Thank you.